Hello and welcome to Talking Tudors, a fortnightly podcast about the ever-fascinating Tudor dynasty. My name is Natalie Gruniger and I'll be your host and guide on this journey through 16th century England. Are you ready to step through the veil of time into the dazzling and dangerous world of the Tudor court? Without further ado, it's time to talk Tudors. Everyone, welcome back to Talking Tudors episode 10. I'm your host, Natalie Gruniger, and joining me today to talk all things Henry VIII is Lauren Johnson. Lauren is a historian specialising in the late medieval period. After gaining her master's in medieval historical research from Oxford University, she began working in heritage in 2008 as a researcher, director and performer in the field of live interpretation, primarily based at the Tower of London and Hampton Court Palace. She's the author of The Arrow of Sherwood, an origin story of Robin Hood, rooted in the brutal reality of the 12th century, and So Great a Prince, England and the Accession of Henry VIII, a non-fiction exploration of daily life in 1509. Her next book will be out in March 2019. Shadow King is a biography of King Henry VI, who inherited the throne as a baby and lost two realms before being murdered in the Tower during the Wars of the Roses. My conversation with Lauren straight after this short musical break, courtesy of guitarist John Sayles. Welcome to Talking Tudors, Lauren. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's great to have you on the show. Could we begin by you telling us just a little bit about yourself and maybe how you came to be interested in the Tudors?
Sure. As far as I can remember, I have always been interested in history and storytelling. And I think I must also have been interested in the Tudors, because when I was a kid, I remember being given, this is a very British thing, an egg cosy. Like, have you heard of a tea cosy?
Yes.
Put on a teapot. There was an egg version of this for your boiled egg, which was in the shape of Elizabeth I. And I can't imagine why I would be given that unless I'd already said I was, oh, Elizabeth I, she's interesting.
That's right.
When I studied history, I studied it at Oxford and then I did a master's. I very much focused a little bit earlier on the medieval and late medieval world, and particularly the Wars of the Roses and women's history in that era.
Right.
So I kind of came back to the Tudors a bit later on when I started working as a live interpreter at Hampton Court Palace and then at the Tower of London. And that's really when I delved into the kind of intricacies of court and what Tudor life was like. So I feel like I sort of came to it late in life, and yet obviously there must have been an existing interest there.
Absolutely. I love the egg cosy. I'm going to have to Google it later and see what that actually looks like. That's fantastic. I love it. Fabulous. Could you talk to us a bit about your book, So Great a Prince, The Accession of Henry VIII?
Sure. The book is basically following the first year of King Henry VIII's reign. So it begins in March 1509, which might seem a bit arbitrary, but it does make sense, honest.
Right.
the Tudor calendar began the new year on the 25th of March,
that's
Lady
right.
Day. And then I follow through that first year of Henry's reign and how he developed as a king, as a husband as well, because mm-hmm. he gets married fairly promptly after coming to the throne.
He does, yes.
And at the same time, what I really wanted to do in this book is not just look at the king, but look at the whole rest of the country, what everyone else was like, because for them, to a certain extent, it didn't really matter who the king was. It mattered what the harvest was like and what the weather did and what your local lord was up to. Or perhaps, you know, was there a trade situation that was concerning if you were a merchant?
Mm.
So I wanted to get this 360-degree sense of daily life in that incredibly important moment in time for British history, but which probably people who are living through it might not have realised was enormously important.
Right, okay.
So it follows lots of different areas of life. I tried to be as wide as possible in terms of geography, in terms of having lots of women in it, having working class people as well as middle class, as well as the court. So, like I said, to try and create this whole world view within one book in a single year.
Yeah, it's absolutely a fascinating book. Now, why, apart from the fact that obviously, you know, a new king's come to the throne, why did you pick this particular year, or why were you drawn to 1509?
I was drawn to it because when I was taught the Tudors at school, and even probably at university, to be honest, there was very much a sense that you have the medieval era, and then, bang, 22nd of August, 1485, suddenly the modern age arrives, and the Tudors come in, and everything changes. And lots of our ideas of the 16th century, really more than the 15th, and of the Tudors, it's, you know, we think of Protestantism coming in, we think of the printing press being established, we think about Shakespeare, like even though he was most of the Tudor era. And what I kept being struck by when I was reading about the early Tudor period was how unlike the late Tudor period it was, how distinctive the Catholicism of that time was, the ritual of religion, liturgy, of the rhythms of the year, how much they were an important part of daily life for people.
Yes, absolutely.
And I wanted to take this moment that could kind of be seen as the bridging point between two different worlds, because you have the old kind of warrior king who's become, I mean, really a sort of a very unpopular king, Henry VII, by the time he dies, an old man by Tudor standards. He's in his 50s.
Mm.
And he's by this young buck who comes to the throne, grounded by good intentions, and then proceeds over the next 40 years to dismantle a huge amount of what has existed for his people with the religious changes and the political upheaval and economic problems that happen in Henry's reign.
Mm.
So I wanted to take what is almost a sort of high point of hope and optimism of Tudor life and explore how people experienced it.
Okay, well, that makes absolutely perfect sense. Now, I just want to touch on something that you said. I have spent a lot of time researching Henry VIII's reign, and I've sort of gone back now to have a look at Henry VII's reign for a project that I'm working on. And it feels quite alien to me. So I wanted to know, what were some of the main differences between Henry VII's court and that of his son, Henry VIII?
I think under Henry VII, there's still a pervasive uncertainty about whether the Tudor dynasty is going to make it.
Yeah.
The fact that for so much of Henry VII's reign, the next heir to the throne is not Henry VIII, it's Arthur.
Mm.
And then he dies quite suddenly, just as the 16th century rolls around, sort of, which then leads to this scramble for, oh, well, should Henry VII be marrying again? Should he be trying to get another heir? What if this young Prince Henry dies as well? What will happen then?
Mm.
I feel like it's characterised by anxiety and
increasing
uncertainty. And of course, there's still the Wars of the Roses are still rumbling on throughout Henry VII's reign. There's battles, there's international politicking, and actually that continues right through into Henry VIII's reign. We sometimes forget, I think, that just because Henry VIII took the throne relatively peacefully, it wasn't a done deal, as it were. This was the first time when Henry VIII took the throne in 1509. It was the first time in almost 100 years since an adult king had succeeded his father peacefully.
Wow, yeah, that's amazing.
Mess.
Yeah. Gosh. All right. And I wondered, you mentioned as well the way in which the religion dictated the rhythm of life. Could you go into that a little bit more and just talk to us about the different ways in which it did?
Absolutely. One of the things that most interests me, actually, when delving into the past, is trying to get my head around how people were thinking in that time. And religion was so monumentally important to the way that people structured their lives in this period. And it was still Catholic, Roman Catholic. It was a universal understanding of, I mean, almost everything. So the fact that the year began at a different point, 25th of March, the fact that the time of day was dictated by daylight, of course, rather than by clocks, but also by the tolling of bells, you know, the sound, the call to prayer almost.
That's right.
You might call it. The fact that throughout the working week you would know there were certain days to fast. Throughout the year there would be entire periods of Lent and Advent when you would basically be living on fish of varying quality depending how rich you were.
Yes.
So what you ate, when you were allowed to have sex, all of these things were prescribed in a way. Yeah. Obviously, you know, that's not necessarily to say that everyone paid attention to those prescriptions.
Yes.
Particularly the sexual ones, people seem to be quite free and easy at ignoring those when they want to. But it was hugely important, and that's why in structuring the book, instead of going 1st January to 1st January and having, you know, maybe 12 months in between, I've got 12 chapters, but each chapter is a high point religiously or ritually throughout the year, because that's how people measured time. It's quite mind-boggling. I'm sure you found this when sometimes when you're looking at documents and it will say, oh, it's the calends of some saint at this particular point.
Oh, that's right.
Or it's the vigils of St. John the Evangelist. And you think, well, when is that?
Exactly. And then you have to go and look it up, just because I don't know all the dates.
Like everything is different. And yeah, so I wanted to get the reader straight into that by setting up a completely different calendar for them in the book.
Yeah, I love that. Absolutely love that. And so could you tell us, obviously this would, you know, Henry's days would change, but what was the sort of average day in the life of King Henry when he was newly crowned like, when he was at home and not travelling?
Oh, it's really tricky because, I mean, even where his home was.
Yes, that's right. In London, obviously, they're moving around a lot.
And within that, like I say, you know, you've got these different ritual high points of the year. So at All Souls, Henry would process through his palace dressed in these magnificent blue mourning robes, mourning, M-O-U-R-N, incidentally, so, yes. You know, grieving robes, essentially. At other points in the year, he would, you know, be fasting. I think the thing that really stood out for me was that variety, actually, was that no 2 days are the same. But I think the theme that ran through Henry's daily life in 1509 was essentially a constant struggle between what he should have been doing, which was seeing to the business of government, what he increasingly wanted to do, which was just have fun.
Yeah,
and you can see, even within the course of this first year of kingship, he moves from being someone who's quite cowed, I would say, by the council who are around him, who are imposing their opinions on him, to the point that he isn't even acclaimed king until 2 days after he's actually come to the throne, because the council are trying to manoeuvre Henry VII's death to their best political advantage.
Right.
And then within a few months, Henry starts to say, "Well, hang on, I want to go to war with France. I want to joust. I want to have fun. I want to have an affair, possibly." And that he is successfully able, as a Tudor king, to start to do that. So that, yeah, huge variety, I'm afraid, is
sort of the answer. that's absolutely fine. And at this, when he sort of first came to the reign, who were the favoured companions of the time?
Again, this is really interesting to me, because I think lots of us imagine the young Henry being surrounded by loads of young, sexy people jousting the entire time. And women as well, actually, I think we picture. And initially, when he comes to the throne, he's pretty much surrounded by old dudes.
Right.
Like, he inherits the people who were responsible for King Henry VII. So someone called Richard Fox, the Bishop of Winchester, is referred to, in fact, as Alter Rex, as the other king.
Right.
Within the first year of Henry's rule, because effectively Richard Fox and the King's Council are sort of are in control of things. And these are all men who are a generation and more older than Henry. But there are some younger persons who start to sort of begin to nudge their way in, I think is probably the best way of putting it. Mm-hmm. So William Compton, who had been in Henry's household as a prince, fairly swiftly moves in and becomes part of his private chamber, becomes his groom of the stool, so right, the person okay. has constant access to Henry, even to the extent of, you know, being responsible for the closed stool, the toilet.
Yes.
And Compton is one of those who is right at the middle of things when Henry is trying to joust for the first time. Compton and Henry dress up as stranger knights in January 1510 and basically in disguise as foreign people go and fight in disguise. Compton's there for that. When Henry has his first romantic entanglements with a woman called Anne, Lady Hastings, again, Compton is right at the heart of that.
Right.
So he's hugely important. And we also start to have some of the names that become very familiar as the Tudor age goes on. So Charles Brandon is around, who becomes Duke of Suffolk. And certainly within 5 years, he is pretty much the chief favourite of King Henry. You've got Thomas Howard, the Earl of Surrey, later the Duke of Norfolk, who is, at this point, which is quite hard to imagine, he's a big jouster.
Right, okay.
Someone who is famed for chivalry and for competing in tournaments. Mm. And then by the mid-1510s, so fairly soon afterwards, there's this bunch of young men coming to court, Francis Bryan, Nicholas Carew, Henry Norris, who become the minions of Henry VIII and who are sort of nudging aside those older members of the court and focusing Henry's mind much more on just having a good time.
Right, yeah.
It takes a little while, but those companions do come in within a few years.
Okay, now I think it was David Starkey that calls sort of Henry and his jousting friends the rock stars of the day. Do you sort of agree with that kind of view?
Yes, yeah, I think so. I think they were hanging out, fighting, obviously tournaments, playing music, enjoying themselves. I think there was, a huge amount of that. And you can see it even in the way that the royal household alters under Henry VIII, the fact that you suddenly have this influx of young people into the privy chamber all hanging out together and speaking familiarly to Henry very early on.
Yeah, well, I wanted to ask you about the royal household, actually, and I wanted to know, because it obviously the structure changes throughout the reign, depending who the monarchy is, etc. How was the royal household structured in the early Tudor reign, as in Henry VIII's reign?
I mean, it's a bit of a nebulous being. I've been doing research for my next book, which is about Henry VI, and the structure of the household is a big bugbear there as well, because some of the things that are there for Henry VI are still persisting into Henry VIII's reign, which is basically what should happen is that you have what we might consider a kind of upstairs-downstairs division, in which the upstairs is called the chamber. It's under the control of a chamberlain, and it's called that because it's literally sort of the room that is more private, into which the king would go in the Middle Ages, as opposed to the hall, which is under the control of the steward and has those servants who are a bit more lowly, who don't get the kind of daily access to the monarch of those in the chamber. By Henry VIII's reign, this is developed even further. So you've got not just one chamber, you've got a whole suite of different chambers getting more and more private. And if you go somewhere like Hampton Court Palace, even though the Tudor rooms don't fully reflect that today, you can see it in the difference between the Great Hall and the Great Watching Chamber. Just immediately, this huge space for all of the servants and then a smaller space for others. And unfortunately, what tends to happen is that it should be only very specific people who go and are eating in the hall, are getting wages, etc. And instead, there's kind of a persistent free-for-all that keeps happening. Where, like, anyone who wants to can sort of pile in. This happens a lot under Henry VI. By Henry VIII's time, it's getting a little bit better. Except that instead of piling into the hall, everyone's trying to pile into the privy chamber.
Right.
So this movement where people are just trying to get closer and closer and closer to the king, because that's where the real power is. And Henry's encouraging it because he brings in these young men who basically he just wants to hang out with and, jam with, maybe, enjoy his music, etc. Then these people sort of are getting closer to the privy chamber. They're hanging out with Henry all the time, when he's sleeping, when he's eating, when he's dressing. And so they therefore have unrivaled access to Henry and become a sort of government among themselves, like a bedchamber, actually, which can be a bit of a threat to the established modes of power of people who are part of a council. or who are, you know, like Thomas Wolsey, someone who is allegedly the chief minister of Henry and yet doesn't get to hang out in the Privy Chamber with all the young kids.
Yeah, well, he tried to reform it all, didn't he? He was sort of like wanting to reduce the number of people hanging around Henry.
Absolutely. It's interesting that you have Thomas Wolsey and Thomas Cromwell both try and completely alter the household makeup and impose order on it, pretty much for their own benefit, to control access to Henry.
Absolutely. And I was reading something today, like towards the end of Henry's reign, he was sort of withdrawing further into rooms that were called the secret rooms. I think they were called secret suite, secret rooms. So he was kind of trying to escape them all by the end, wasn't he?
Yeah, which is exactly what Henry the Seventh did. I mean, the Privy Chamber or secret chamber, the term is used under Henry the Seventh as well.
Right.
Effectively, Henry the Seventh was trying to just get some work done away from the court later in life. And it's interesting, it comes full circle with Henry the Eighth. He starts off with this free-for-all, everyone come and hang out with me, and then by the end of his reign, exactly like you say, he's just trying to have some alone time.
Tricky. All right, so I think that more often than not, when people think of Henry VIII, they don't picture the sort of handsome, athletic, charismatic Renaissance prince of 1509, but rather, you know, someone overweight and paranoid and I guess the tyrant of his later years. And this transformation has been the subject of obviously a lot of debate. I'd just love to hear what you think caused it, whether you think it was a sort of gradual transformation, whether you think maybe it was a result of a medical condition or something else. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I was really ready when I started researching 1509 to basically fall in love with Henry, to find him this delightful young person who was later on corrupted. And I really didn't. Like, I think basically Henry VIII was just not a tremendous human being, probably. I think it was interesting that during the time that he was prince, and particularly after Arthur's death, but before he became king, Henry VIII was extremely controlled by his father. Description by one Spanish ambassador that Henry VIII was treated like a girl by his father. He's not allowed to talk sort of without his father's permission. He's kept incredibly stiflingly close to him. And that when he takes the throne in 1509, I think it's effectively the shackles come off. And he, at the age of 17, which I think is really important to emphasize, he suddenly goes into this sort of chaotic year of, oh, well, I'm going to joust, I'm going to dance, I'm going to enjoy, I'm going to do what I want at last. This is going to be my time. And I don't think he ever fully recovers from that impulse. I think he spends the whole of the rest of his reign wanting to do exactly what he wants and for other people to clear up the mess when necessary. And, yeah, I don't personally think there is a point at which that substantially changes. I know there's a theory that maybe in 1536 he has a jousting injury, and that leads to a kind of a head trauma that might have altered his personality. I think he was already that personality. I came out more.
Absolutely. Well, yeah, when he was obviously not able to do the things he loved anymore and in chronic pain, that must have had some effect.
Yeah, and I think that will have affected him. But also he's got Cromwell around him by that point, who is contrary to Hilary Mantel's fairly sympathetic portrait. I think Cromwell was a fairly ruthless and unpleasant person as well.
Definitely.
And I think he enables Henry to do these things. Not to say that Henry wouldn't necessarily have got rid of Anne Boleyn himself, but I think Cromwell manoeuvres that political coup in a rather ruthless fashion.
I just
think it's so difficult for us to imagine what it would be like in your formative years, which your late teenage years are, to suddenly have absolute power, and not just terrestrial power, but power given to you by God in the anointing of coronation. That you're, the whole rest of your life, no one can question you. Really, no one, although, like I said, some of Henry's young friends during the early 1510s speak familiarly with him. That's something he comes to really resent later on. He doesn't want people necessarily to treat him just like a man. He's not a man. He's something other.
That's
he's,
right. Yeah. He's
the next thing to God, as he makes himself, in fact, when he reforms the church. So I think that tyrannical impulse, the authoritarian streak, is always there, and it just gets more pronounced as he gets older.
Right. And do you think that he, some sort of theories or what I've read before say that, you know, Henry was easily manipulated. Others believe that he wasn't, that that was sort of the game that he played, pitching one person against the other person. What do you think on that front?
I don't know. I think, I'm not sure he was easily manipulated. I think he let himself be manipulated when it suited him.
When it suited him, yeah, I sort of feel the same way.
He did still retain control over situations. I think he also had an astonishing capacity to switch off a part of his brain.
Yes.
To the unpleasantness that he caused. The fact that he's able to leave, you know, leave a palace where he knows his wife is going to be arrested and ultimately killed.
Yes, yeah.
Without a backward glance almost. I think, yeah, he had a capacity for cruelty, but wouldn't have seen it as cruelty himself.
No, that's right. And, sorry, one more question. All these things are coming to mind as I'm chatting with you. What do you think about sort of, you know, people have labelled him, obviously, you know, he's a psychopath, he's a narcissist, is this. What do you think about sort of putting these modern labels on people that lived 500 years ago? Do you think this helps us at all, or do you think we're better off just trying to get into their minds and understand how the people around him saw him at the time?
This is such an interesting question. And again, sorry to harp on about Henry VI. But it's something that's hugely come up with him, because he is a king who's remembered as being a mad king.
That's right. Yeah.
And I have two feelings about it. One is that it can be very interesting to look backwards and say, oh, maybe what about this new theory, to examine people that way. And the other one is, particularly with questions of mental health, I think it's quite unhelpful to say this person is a psychopath and therefore we can not condone, but we can make absolute sense of all of their decisions in a highly complicated political era.
Yes.
Rather than looking at the complexity of, first, of every human being and the evolution of human beings, you know, Henry changed throughout his life, as do we all.
Yes.
And also politics changes throughout people's lives. I mean, there's been, with a current world leader, there's been a lot of movements to go, oh, this person has this definite mental health problem.
Yes.
And why they behave this way. And actually, it sort of lets them off the hook, because it says, no, they've got this one thing, it's easily definable, and they needn't look any further. And also sometimes associating mental health traits with negative behaviours, I think that can be problematic as well. So, yeah, I think it's something we need to be cautious of.
Okay, fabulous. Oh, that's fantastic. Look, I'm absolutely loving our conversation. We are up to playing 10 to go, Lauren. Are you ready for it?
Yeah.
All right, excellent. Can you name a show that you've binge-watched?
Oh, a show I've binge-watched.
Oh, have you? Have you done any binge-watching? Maybe you haven't.
I've been really restrained recently. Because I spent the first 6 months of this year basically in the 15th century writing.
Right. Oh, you're good. So you didn't let yourself get distracted.
Oh, I couldn't. It was among the most intense writing periods I've had, I think. And I'm only just emerging now.
Right.
And in Britain, we've had the most glorious summer, so I've been outside exposing my pale skin to vitamin D.
All right, maybe you'll do a bit of binge watching when you go into winter, perhaps.
Yes, Great British Bake Off is always a good one for that,
All
I think.
Right, fabulous. So can you name two items that are on your bucket list?
Until a couple of years ago, one of them was going to Machu Picchu in Peru.
Yes.
And I finally did it, and it was wonderful. So I've ticked that one off.
Fabulous.
Much closer to home. I don't know why I've still not managed to do this. I really want to go to Pompeii and Herculaneum.
Oh. That would be fantastic.
I just remember being a kid and reading National Geographic books in the 80s and finding pictures of the bodies essentially from Pompeii and being completely bewitched by what had happened there. So yeah, I'd really like to visit that.
Okay, that sounds fantastic. What's something that you do to recharge?
Well, it's a bit dull, but essentially it's seeing humans.
Right, okay, that's not dull at all.
Is to go out, you know, just hang out with friends, have a conversation. I find you sort of, I don't know if you find this as well, Natalie, but sometimes when you're just spending all time researching or writing, you become a weird sort of monastic human being who loses the ability to speak.
Absolutely.
And it's nice to remind yourself you have, you know, a mouth.
Yeah, that's right. No, that's so true. I agree. Apart from obviously writing and history, what's something that brings you joy?
I really like gardening.
Oh,
I'm finding that soothing as an activity, because it's something that you don't entirely have control over. There's an element of nature doing what it wants.
There is. Yeah, so true. I love gardening as well. Could you name a favourite childhood book?
Probably Little Women would be right up.
Yes, I love it.
Four brothers, so I was always really jealous of the masters.
I can understand that, yeah. So you've been doing a lot of writing, obviously, this year. Can you describe a day in your life when you're writing? So do you have any sort of rituals that you follow or anything like that?
Yeah, increasingly I do.
Do you?
I'm an absolute fool in the afternoons. Trying to write in the afternoons for me is completely pointless. So I have to get up early in the morning. I have to start writing and try and get as much done in the morning as possible. Mm. I get up, I have my breakfast, my cup of tea, and then I make my coffee, which I have to make in a very specific sort of, it's an air press coffee.
Right.
I take that upstairs, right. Start working. And then in the afternoon, I try and do something, you know, exercise-wise, so yoga, Pilates, or cycling. Just so that I have actually used my body at some point during the day. Otherwise you feel like a potato.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. I know that I have to write in the mornings too, and I know people that can write really late at night, and I actually don't understand to be honest.
No, with you. I have to stop by about 8 o'clock, because there's it just becomes pointless.
Exactly. Mix up all your Henrys after that, that's for sure.
Exactly.
What is something, or is there something, that most people don't know about you?
Oh my goodness.
There might not be. I don't know.
People don't know a huge amount about me in general.
Well, there you go. So there probably is.
One thing is I'm completely obsessed with the Tour de France. Actually, that's a big thing. I do tend to spend the month of July sitting watching men in Lycra pedaling around France. I can literally sit for 6 hours.
Wow.
And watch a stage of the Tour de France.
Oh,
I'm obsessed.
My goodness. Very
good. And it's currently, there's the Vuelta going on at the minute, the Tour of Spain, so I'm watching that.
Lovely. I don't mind watching it a bit, just to see all the scenery and, you know, the beautiful houses in France and whatnot. But yeah, the cycling, I don't think I could sit through 6 hours. Very good. All right. So what's the best piece of advice, or a really good piece of advice that you've been given?
The best one my husband gave me when I was writing my first book, The Arrow of Sherwood. And it was very simple. It was just keep writing.
Yeah, that is a good piece of advice.
Exactly. Just keep writing. Don't question it, right? Because the more you write, the better you get. And it's so true.
That is really true. Well, sometimes I look back at some things that I wrote for my first book, and really, I do cringe. I think,
Oh my gosh.
You know, at best, I don't think I want to look back. right. So what's the first word that comes to mind when I say Elizabeth the First?
Well, now it's going to be egg cozy.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that. I love it. Egg cozy, good.
Or wig would be the other one.
Yep.
Ginger wig.
Yeah, okay. Egg cozy and wig, excellent. And lucky last question. If you could travel back to see one event in Tudor history, what would it be?
Oh, wow. So exciting. it would be something in the 15th century. It might, maybe the Battle of Bosworth or the aftermath of the Battle of Bosworth would be intriguing. I mean, seeing all of those individuals who are so fascinating, I'd have to sort of run around invisibly, presumably, in this permutation.
Yes, that's right.
I'd have to just run between them and see what people looked like and how they spoke to each other and what went on and how it all unfolded. I think that might be, yeah.
Oh, absolutely. I often think, I imagine just seeing them in the flesh. Like, I try and picture it, and it's like, hurts my brain, really.
Mm.
All right. So that's our 10 questions. We're up to our tutor takeaway, Lauren. Do you have something for us to go and explore or look at or read after the episode?
Yeah. Am I allowed two? Because one of them is quite short.
Yes, please. I love when people say that. That's great. Love to.
So one of them is the British Library digitized manuscripts. Ooh. And you might be thinking, what's that got to do with the Tudors? It has got a lot of medieval manuscripts on, but it's also got loads of beautiful books of hours. Mm. One of my favourite things is zooming in on the digitised manuscripts.
Yes.
And seeing loads of them, especially the books of hours, but some of the other works as well, the breviaries and so on, have just normal people in them.
Mm.
You know, just what people were doing throughout the year. And you can zoom in and see, oh, that person's, you know, there's one, in fact, I think it might be Isabel of Castile's breviary, where there's a guy in one part of the picture who's just sort of leaning over and mooning.
Oh.
I think he's supposed to be getting in the harvest.
Okay.
But, you know, it's just like a mooning picture. Why not? And they're really, you can go down a complete wormhole of looking at those. And the other one is another of our senses, would be a song by William Cornish called Our Robin, which I'm sure you or many of your listeners will have heard. Because in my life as a costumed interpreter, I spend a lot of time hanging out in palaces and trying to get people to talk to me and realise that I'm not weird. I'm working. And one of the really good ways I've found to draw people in or to give them an experience that's a bit different in a historic site without them having to actively engage with you is just to sing and to sing songs from the era that you're within. So Our Robin is one of, I think, the most beautiful songs that is around in the court of King Henry VIII.
Well, I don't even know if I've heard it. I'm going to listen straight after this just to see. Now, so you sing, is that right? You sing?
Yes. Yeah, not very well. I do it.
Fabulous. I love singing. I'm not good at it, but I do enjoy it.
Yeah,
it
makes me feel good. And even if you're quite bad at it, I find that people are just so delighted in modern life to That's hear someone doing it. They can be very understanding.
They can, which is fabulous. Well, they're fantastic tutor takeaways. Thank you so much. And thank you so much for joining me on Talking Tutors. I've really had a really lovely time, and I wish you much luck with your new book. When's it out, Lauren?
It will be out early March next year.
Early March.
It's called Shadow the King.
Fabulous. Adding it to the list. Adding it to my very long TBR list that I've got. I keep adding to.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. Thank you very much for having me. It's been lovely chatting with you.
Oh, fabulous. Thank you so much. Well, that brings us to the end of this episode of Talking Tutors. Thank you so much for listening. If you have any comments or suggestions or just want to say hi, please get in touch with me via my website www.onthetutortrail.com, where you will also find show notes for today's episode. If you've enjoyed the show, please share the podcast with friends and family and click on the all-important follow button so you'll never miss an episode. I also invite you to join our Talking Tutors podcast group on Facebook, where you can interact with other Tudor history lovers and hear all the behind-the-scenes news. It's time now for us to re-enter the modern world. As always, I look forward to talking Tudors with you again very soon.